Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Glad you can come to my second lecture on cloud computing. I'm David Platt. We met in the first lecture. And this lesson is on basic architecture. All right? We talked in the previous lesson about what the cloud was and what problems did the cloud solve well. Right? And if you've gone to the second lesson, well, you must have thought, okay, well, that does sound kind of interesting. Those do sound like the kinds of problems I have or I want to be able to solve. And these patterns do make a certain amount of sense. So let's go see. All right, that sounds good. So now what the heck do we do? Continuing the analogy with electric power, which I like very much. Now we have software, and the software needs to be able to plug into the cloud to do its computing. Right. That is very similar to the problem that mechanical and electrical designers were solving in the first part of the 20th century. They're saying, all right, the electricity comes out of the wall now, comes out of a utility instead of our own generators. Okay, how do we have to modify our electrical devices to use this commodity-supplied electricity? And now how do we modify our compute devices to use this commodity-supplied computations? For example, in the electric power, they couldn't have just any frequency that they wanted. It was 60 hertz that came out of the wall. So even if they generated it locally at 55 hertz, well, now they had to change their motors to run on 60 hertz. And so here we're used to running our programs locally. What kinds of changes do we have to make to our program architecture in order to run this in the cloud? All right, that's what we're going to be talking about in this lesson. Before I launch into this, though, I want to talk about a little bit of background, some common patterns in distributed programming. And the thought is that we're aiming these course modules at either second year or third year computer science students. Certainly, they need to understand basic programming that would get the first year, but we didn't want to make it a fourth year either. So it's entirely possible that if you're watching this, that you have not yet had a class on distributed programming and distributed systems. So there needs to be some amount of discussion here about the kinds of principles that you get. If you're programming just on one box, well, you could program in a certain way. But once you start going from this box over here to that box over there, well, now you've got some different kinds of problems to solve that you didn't have on a single box. And so some different programming patterns that one uses. So if you have had this before, my suggestion is you'll find it a good review. If you haven't, listen up and pay really good attention because this stuff is going to come back and bite you. Okay, background, part zero. I call it virtualization. And we're talking about machines that live somewhere else. When this machine breaks, I can repave it. When I want more memory, I can plug in more memory. When I want to change its configuration, give it a larger hard disk or a smaller one, I can just do that. I can change it, no problem. But now, we're dealing with machines that are off in the cloud somewhere. They could easily be 5,000 miles away. I can't ever touch them. So it is important, in general, to isolate ourselves from the changes that the hardware can and frequently will have. I mean, if I deploy to Microsoft's data center in Chicago, say, and I get my deployment up and working, well, tomorrow the PC, the physical PC on which I'm running, blows a fuse. And they don't fix these PCs in the racks anymore. They take them out, they throw them away, they get a new one from Dell and plug it in. And it is probably a newer PC, it is probably a faster PC, it is probably a bigger PC, it is most certainly a different PC. So it is very important that they not affect my software at all. So in general, we don't write our program to specific hardware, but rather we run it on these virtual machines. And you can see the notion of a virtual machine here in this stack. There's the cloud stack. Down at the bottom, you have hardware. And generally, you would see an operating system on top of the hardware. But instead, what you're seeing here in that turquoise layer, that's the virtual machine manager. And so that is a virtual machine that runs on top of the hardware. And so you program against that virtual machine rather than the specific hardware machine. So now if the hardware changes, the virtual machine that you're on does not change. And that minimizes the type, that decouples, if you will, your application from the physical hardware that it runs on. Now, obviously, there's a layer. Obviously, it burns some CPU cycles, right? As we say in the computing business, which you aspire to enter, the universal solution to any compatibility problem is one more layer of abstraction, which is what you're seeing here. Right? Of course, the universal solution to any performance problem is removing one level of abstraction. But that's life. Anyway, the hardware dependency is generally a bad thing. So it's the hardware dependency is worse than the piece than the computing cycles consumed by a virtual machine manager. So just about everybody runs in a virtual machine, and pretty much nobody runs on raw iron anymore, right? So, second part of distributed computing, I want to talk about abstraction. You learn object-oriented programming, and a lot of objects assume that they are used locally. I mean, back when objects were first being thought of in the late 80s, early 90s, distributed programming was nowhere near as common as it is today, and the classic object-oriented sense, you probably had that in the second half of your first year of computer science, the classic object-oriented sense of the term, where you have an object is this thing containing both state and behavior and methods, as you see in the diagram, classic combination of code and data. But when you start going over a wire, that's kind of a little different. Instead, you have something like this. The client, the entity that is making the calls, is on one kind of box over here. And the server, the guy that is taking the request, doing the thinking, and giving back the results, is on a different box. So the request has to travel over the wire from the client to the server, get thought about on the server, results travel back to the client. All right. And so you don't usually have a direct connection from the client to the server. That was tried a little bit in sort of Microsoft DCOM back around 1994. Certain RPC projects had it. Taking the object-oriented idea and just extending it straight across the network gap, it's actually a lot trickier than you think. So instead, what you usually do, as you see here in this diagram, the client, one on the left, that has a proxy object. It looks like the object. It feels like the object. It's got the same methods as the object would have if it were local. It has they take the same parameters. It has the same return codes. But instead of the actual computation that the object has, instead, the proxy has communication code, pretty much just communication code. So when the client calls a method on the proxy squirts the request over to the server. Server thinks about it. Server gives back the results. Come back to the proxy. Proxy unpacks it off the wire and gives the result back to the client. So it looks. So the proxy looks to the client as if it were a local object. It feels like a local object. The programmer thinks of it as a local object because that's an easy way to think. It's a familiar way to think. But it isn't really a local object, even though it looks and feels like one. And you really shouldn't treat it like one. You know, when you've got these new kinds of problems, the client makes a call. Now, what happens if some idiot yanks the plug out of the wall on the server side after the client makes a call, but before the result comes back? Well, did the thing happen or not? Did the request get in? Did the request get serviced or not? You don't know. So that is just one example of the new kinds of problems that we have when you go from one box to a different box. So, anyway. So that is what abstraction looks like. You generally look and feel with objects because they look familiar, they feel familiar, they're comfortable, it's fine. But they don't let that look and feel confuse you, because you really are crossing network boundaries, and there are entirely new classes of problems that need to get solved when you need to do this. Okay, next one, part and parcel of abstraction, is statelessness. You've got this client over here, you've got that server over there, and it looks like the proxy is connected to an actual object, but it's difficult to do. How does the one know that the other is still there? How do each parties know that the other one is still alive and still talking, and that some idiot hasn't yanked the plug out of the wall? The answer is that's actually surprisingly tricky. You can do heartbeats back and forth. It's hard. It takes time and effort that you would much rather put into your business logic. So, load balancing is difficult. You hit an object now and it comes back, and then you hit an object 5 minutes later. Are you talking to the same object? Again, good question. It is usually a better idea to design your objects so that they don't expect their internal state to be maintained from one call to the other. The proxy on the client side often stays alive, but it's connected to a different object instance on the server side every time it makes its call. Here's an example of that. We've got the client 1 on the proxy on the left, time equals 0. The client number 1 makes a call to the service host and gets instance number 1. That's fine. At t equals 0, client number 2 on the right makes a call to its proxy. It goes to the service host. It goes to instance number 2. And then, sometime later, t equals 1, client number 2 proxy on the right hand makes another call to the service host. And now it gets a different instance of the object. And so even though client number 2 made the same call on its, made the call on its proxy, made call method A on its proxy, then sometime later called method B on the same proxy. So client number 2 thinks it's talking to the same object. It feels like it's talking to the same object. In fact, on the service host side, on the server side, it's talking to a different object instance. And this goes by the somewhat ambiguous term of stateless objects. If instance number 2 retained the state from the first call, client makes the call on instance number 2, instance number 2 does some thinking, and instance number 2 now retains the state based on that call, the way it would in a classic object sense. When client number 2 makes the next call, well, then you got to connect it to the exact same object. All right? The exact same object. And it's hard. That means you can't load balance them easily. That means you got to keep track that both sides are alive. Actually, rather difficult. So instead, what you do, mostly, is this. There's the client, and the service host there in the center. That, we call the object stateless. It doesn't mean that no data is retained. Data is retained. What it does mean is the state is not returned in the object instances. That's the key. Not in the object itself. The state was somewhere else. There in client number 2. There, time equals 0, client number 2 calls instance number 2. Instance number 2 does some thinking. Instance number 2 gives the result back to the client. Now, instead of keeping its own internal state, instance number 2 stores its internal state in the database, that big cylinder you see at the bottom. All right? Stores it in that cylinder. So the data doesn't disappear. The state does live. Just lives in the database. It doesn't live in an object instance. That way, when client number 2 comes back, makes another call, is connected to instance number 3. Well, now instance number 3 pulls the previous state out of the database and is right back where it was. So the data is maintained in this database in between calls. This is a lot simpler. Now, the client number 2 talking to the proxy, talking through the proxy to the instances. Now it doesn't really care which instance it goes to, because it can get load balanced to any machine, because all the data lives in the central database. Right? So that is generally a better pattern for arranging objects in distributed systems. I'm not saying there's never a case for storing state in object instances, but much more common is this one. Now obviously it gives you a hotspot in the database, and there are ways of programming around that. But anyway, that's what we mean when we say stateless objects. Doesn't mean no state is maintained. State most definitely is maintained. But it is not maintained in the object instances. It's maintained in the database. Keeping in the object instances causes you all kinds of trouble. All right. Next piece I want to talk about is chunkiness. When you have a local object, making a call to the object is fairly cheap. Looks cheap. It feels cheap. It is cheap. You want to suppose you have an object that represents a customer. You make a call. You can call a method. You can hit a property and fetch the guy's first name. You make another one to fetch his last name. You fetch another one to fetch his middle name, and so on. All right, you can do that. It's quick. The overhead is very low. Problem is when you start extending that over a distributed system. Now the call overhead is much, much higher. You got the client over here on the client side with its proxy. You got the server on the other side of the world in some sort of internet situation. So you make a call on the local object to fetch the customer's first name. It's got to get packaged up into XML. It's got to go out through your firewall. It's got to hit the remote server. It's got to get decomposed. It's got to, object's got to get created. Then it's got to do the thinking on the remote server. Got to get the response. Got to recode it. Got to bounce off the routers again. Got to come back into the client. Got to get recomposed. And then comes out as a string. All right, so you know it's non-trivial. Again, the object looks and feels local. It looks and feels like these calls are simple, but the overhead has gone up by an awful lot. All right. So it is important to make fewer calls and passing more data in each call. If you think about all of these operations, they go up a certain amount with the size of data, but the overhead call is very high. The overhead per call, just the headers and stuff, is very high. So you need to think for each project just what is the optimum level of chunkiness. If you were fetching customer data, you probably don't want to make one call to get his first name and one call to get another call to get his last name and another call to get his middle name and so on. You probably want to make one call and get his first name and last name and middle name and prefix and suffix and probably his address, etc., etc. So I was doing a test when I was writing two or three books ago. I did a test on web services, and I found that the overhead of one call was it was about 1 millisecond per call, then plus about 1 millisecond per 100K of data. That's about what it ran in that particular test. So so fetching 50K of data or even 100K of data to avoid just one extra call, that's about where my break-even point was. Now, obviously, your mileage will vary greatly. And whenever you do any sort of project in any sort of distributed computation, figuring out just exactly what is the optimal level of chunkiness is absolutely critical. But chunkiness is key. In general, you're going to be transferring a lot of data per call, a lot more data per call, and a lot fewer calls is what you're looking for. Right? And perform that test very early on in the design process, if I were you, because it is going to dictate a lot of your choices. And finally, I want to talk about message passing. Once you have this box over here and that box over there, the client over here wants to talk to that box over there and then get some response back from that client over there to this client over here. Well, to make that happen, both of these boxes have to be up and alive and talking at the same time. That is actually extremely difficult. Try this example. You make a phone call to somebody and they're not there. So what do? Well, you leave voicemail, don't you? And then they get your voicemail when they get back or whenever it is, and they call you, return your call, and you're not there. So they leave a voicemail. When was the last time you called somebody on the telephone and they were there, and they answered the call and they were there, and they answered you and they talked to you, and you went back and forth and got what you wanted done? I don't know. I got to sit down and think a while. It's you know, 5 or 10 to 1. We leave voicemails versus actually talk to the same guy at the same time. And that's the problem that we have in computing. You got this box over here, that box over there. What are the chances that they are both alive and talking and listening at the same time? And the answer is damn near zero. Right? So what do? Well, we could change our computing patterns, don't we? Here on the client side, our program makes a call and wants to talk to that machine. But the machine isn't there. So the data gets stored. Data gets stored locally on the client or perhaps on some other intermediary. And then when the conditions are right for sending it across, it gets sent to the server. Maybe the server program, answering program, isn't running right then, so it gets stored in the server's inbox until the program starts running and checking its inbox to see what was there, pulls out the request, thinks about it, gives some response. Well, now maybe the client isn't listening, so again, it goes in the outbox, sits in the outbox for a while until there's a connection to the client, gets sent back, sits in the client's inbox for a while until the client program starts running and can read it out of the inbox and think about it. When you start getting into distributed computing, this pattern shows up a lot because it solves the problem of the two machines not being at the same place at the same time. The programming model is a little bit different. You can't get any immediate output parameters, for example, on a voicemail. You say, hey, look, can you meet me at Joe's at 5 o'clock? Well, you know, you don't expect an answer. You leave all the information that you need, and eventually, you hope, in time, back will come a voicemail that says, no, I can't make it until 5, and I'll make it at 6, or whatever. So that's what we do a lot of in distributed computing, and you're going to see this when we get up into the cloud. All right? And here's a diagram. Okay, the client takes a message, gives it to the message broker, puts it in a queue. The message gets passed to the service. There it is on the server side. The service instances pick it out. That's half of it. That's passing a message from the client to the server. That doesn't show the server sending it back to the client, although it would be the exact same thing, just flipped 180 degrees. All right. So those are some common distributed computing patterns that we see. So we're going to the cloud. If that was new to you, good. Good thing you learned it. If that was not new to you, well, it's a good thing you had it reviewed and just put it to the front of your mind. Okay, I'm now going to talk a little bit more about the cloud architecture of the different vendors. And here, I'm going to talk about Amazon first. They were the first guys to come out with this. Their main computation engine is called the Amazon Elastic Compute Cloud. All right. You create Amazon Machine Images, AMIs they call them, containing your choice of operating system, and they can have Linux or Windows. And then on that AMI, you run whatever programs you want. If you have a Windows AMI, you are probably going to run IIS, Internet Information Server, on it, so it can take requests from the web. If you've got Linux, you're probably going to run the Apache server or something like that. This is sort of the classic infrastructure as a service, to the extent that that buzzword has a specific meaning. The classic service that it gives you the computing platform and the operating system, but doesn't give you anything that runs on top of the operating system. Doesn't give you a database, doesn't give you a web server. It's just the operating system that you get from the cloud vendor. Okay, Amazon has many other things that you could buy. But my point, and we'll see some of these, my point is that the Elastic Compute Cloud is, to the extent anybody pays attention to those buzzwords, infrastructure as a service. Okay. You can also go buy additional services. You can buy storage. You can buy payment processing. They are available a la carte, and we will see them a little more in our next lesson about storage. And that is more the platform as a service model that we see. All right. And these guys have been around for a while. They've clearly, you can see with their spot market for computation that I talked about in the first lesson, that they are working on this availability problem, that they've been thinking about just how to load balance, thinking about how to make compute instances available to people, thinking about just how to handle these differing seasonal loads. If you look at the continuing the electric power model, there are all kinds. I worked in an industry back in grad school, and you would not believe the amount of effort that goes into forecasting load, watching the weather to see if it's going to be hot, to see if the air conditioning load is going to go up, to bring plants online, to take plants offline, to enter into different service level agreements with different customers. They will agree with some of their larger customers that on really hot days they can cut power to that customer, and that customer will turn off some of their AC in return for a lower rate. There is in New Hampshire, for example, the nighttime electric rates for electric usage are much, much lower than in the daytime. If anybody ever gets electric cars in New Hampshire, they will take advantage of that. If enough people take advantage of that, the differential will disappear. There are all kinds of fiddling that one does with demand forecasting and the shaping of demand through pricing models and things of this nature. And as far as I can tell, Amazon is a little farther down the road along those lines than either of the other two. I'm sure they're coming along quickly. Amazon's the guy with the spot market right now. Okay, this one is Google. And Google is pretty simple. Pink thing in sort of the center right of that model is the app. You plug that into their VMs. It's kind of a straight request response model. There's your computation in the center. Google provides some stateful API, stateful service APIs, they call them. That is their storage. There's that memory caching, so you can cache pieces in the easily accessed memory. There's the data store. That's their relational piece. There's the blob store that stores data in the form of blobs, which we'll see more in the next lesson. There are some stateless services that they can use. Things like there's a task queuing that you can have. There's a URL fetch. You give it a URL and it just goes and fetches you the data. There's a mail service, imaging service, things of that nature. This is, according to one of the authors that is credited at the end of this note, it's think RPC, just request in processing, response out. It works very well for the web and for Ajax. The application is quite simple. It's built to scale out very well. You just plug in any number of apps. The term stupid, simple and stupid, gets used. I'm not so sure I buy that one. Simple, maybe. Don't confuse simple with stupid. It is hard to make something simple. So if you make it simple, I think that's a smart thing. Anyway, it's mostly, again, infrastructure as a service, not so much platform as a service. I will bet you anything that that changes drastically within the next year or two. I'll bet you. You know, they've got so many machines sitting around. I mean, they call it the Googleplex, right? They've got so many machines. They can earn money with them. Those guys are pretty smart. I'll bet they're coming. But that's what we have today. It's fairly simple. Out of Google. Now this one is Microsoft. They call it Windows Azure, and this is an overview of it. You've got users there on the internet. I like that diagram. It shows the cloud, and it shows where the cloud boundary is, and it tells you what's on your side of the cloud, what's on the other side of the cloud. The amorphous shape of the cloud sort of, again, to my mind, visually reinforces the fact that you're going into a place where you're not really in control. The way it used to be when it was right here under your thumb. I like that diagram. This comes from a white paper written by David Chappell, again, which you will find in the credits. All right, so you've got applications. That's the part that you write. They sit on top of the Windows Azure system, and according to the applications, Windows Azure looks like their operating system. They really don't know any different. Like, there are layers underneath, but the applications generally don't really see them. Azure runs on lots of Windows PCs. It runs in a data center. I would call this platform as a service. The storage is there. The compute instances are there. The message passing is there. Relational data is there. I'd call it platform as a service myself, to the extent I would pay any attention to those buzzwords at all. So we'll look at the Azure layer here. And if you can see, there is the orange block that says compute. That's the guy that does the computing, does the thinking. I'll be talking about that more in this particular lecture. There's the storage, the blue sort of drum that you see on the right-hand side, and I'll be talking about that in the next lesson. At the bottom, that's the fabric, if you will. That is the connection of your application to the Azure system. If you want your programs, your applications, to be able to talk to the fabric and spin up another instance or something like that, that's where they would go. And that, we do not currently have a lesson on that scheduled. If you'd like one, talk to your Microsoft representative and tell them that, yes, this is something you wish that they would get for you. And if enough people ask for it, I'll bet something of that nature could be done. All right. So, now, continuing, drilling on down here. The compute service runs the application, as I said. The storage services, we will see in the next lesson, has things like tables, blobs, queues, even has some relational storage, a thing called SQL Azure. We'll see it in the next lesson. And the fabric is the control and the management of the Azure service itself. In the compute layer, we have what are called compute instances, and they come in two flavors. There's a web role or a worker role. I myself really don't care for the R word in this context. I always think of that word as having something to do with security, right? You have the bank teller role and the manager role, the doctor role, the nurse's role. To me, you know, it means a group of users with a certain set of security privileges. And here, I myself would prefer to think of them as web instances or worker instances. That to my mind makes it fit into my mental model better. But if you look in the Microsoft documentation, the R word is what they use. If you're finding that a teeny bit confusing, you're not the only one. When you set up your service agreement, when you talk to Microsoft and sign a contract and say you're going to buy so many of these things, it will tell you the number and the size of the virtual machines containing compute instances that you can run. There's a small compute instance that's got that much CPU and that much memory and that much storage, et cetera, et cetera. Small and medium and large, you know, extra large, fine. And that's what you can get in the compute layer when you sign your service level agreement. Right? Now, here, I found this one a little tricky. So when I was reading the initial documentation, this was not clear, and I will try to make it clearer. And that said that each virtual machine contains just one instance of a role, either one web role or one worker role, but never two roles, and therefore never two roles of opposite kinds, because there is only ever one and only one role. When I see them sort of stacked on top of these, as you see here, that, you know, the web role instance on the left and the worker role instance on the right, when I see them stacked, that doesn't sometimes that's not quite clear to me. The point is, each VM has a single role into it. You can think of that as kind of the virtual operating system, I suppose. I'm still working on my mental model for that one. Each virtual machine contains one and only one role instance, either of the web flavor or of the worker flavor. What's the difference, I hear you ask? Well, here's the difference. The web role is the computing object, and it is exposed to the outside internet because the virtual machine that it runs in contains Microsoft IIS version 7 right now. So it can speak to the outside world through any technology compatible with IIS 7, such as ASP.NET. That works fine if you want to run a web server with lots of HTML pages and so on. WCF, well, Windows Communication Foundations, if you want to run web services as opposed to pages, that works just fine. Or any other .NET technology that works with IIS. Okay, now I'm going to talk about some common usage scenarios, some common ways in which these objects are arranged to accomplish things that you want to have done. Here's an example, a scalable web application. You've got lots and lots of people that want to play the web game. You've got many web roles to handle the different users coming in. You've got data stored in tables. An example would be an online multiplayer game. My two daughters right now, who are 10 and 7, are just absolutely enamored of PixieHollow.com, a Disney website where you can create fairies and dress them in costumes and have their hair cut and have them fly around. They do things like, they play games like help the baby birds in the nest learn how to fly. I'd rather have them do that than carnivore, okay? But if you did that, you would have something like this. Here's the pattern. There on the left, you had an HTML or Silverlight in a browser, many different browsers. And there on the right, you would have many different web roles, which is many different VMs containing IIS. And Azure would automatically load balance for you. You would store data there in Azure queues, tables, and blobs, which is what we're going to be seeing in the next lesson. You might or might not have some background processing there, but you would have lots and lots of web roles. Those are the outward-facing pieces that get requests from browsers or rich internet applications. So that's the kind of thing that one would have for a scalable multiplayer game. Lots of web roles, relatively few, possibly no worker roles. On the other hand, consider, suppose you had a parallel processing application. That pharmaceutical molecule modeling that I was talking about in the first lesson, for example, you'd have lots and lots of worker roles to process the data and perform calculations. The data would be stored perhaps in blobs. You would have one web role for control so that the operator could start it and stop it and things like this. The roles would communicate with each other via queues. And here, this is a diagram where that would be. There would be just one web role for controlling it, or perhaps a web service. The data would come in by means of a queue. You would have, there's one worker role shown, but you would probably have a whole lot more of them, each doing one portion of the calculation. And that's the kind of thing that you would have with worker roles. So those are the sorts of ways in which you could arrange these kinds of objects to accomplish the different sorts of things that you might want to do. All right, and the next thing I'm going to do, kind of finish up this lesson, by demonstrating a thumbnail application from the Azure SDK.
Okay, good afternoon. And here I am with the demonstration that goes with lesson number 2. And you will find this, again, in the C drive, MS Cloud Module V1, there. This is in lesson 2, Basic Application Architecture. And this is the Lesson 2 and 3 thumbnail demo. We will be using this for this Lesson 2 that we're working on now. And we will also be using it for some in Lesson 3 as well. So, if you look, there is the thumbnails.solution file. And you open that up there. And what you get is this here. Here's this project. What I have is I have a web project with two different roles in it. An Azure project with two different roles on it. This here is Thumbnail's web role, and that there is Thumbnail's worker role. Now the way it works is this. When I run it here, there, up comes a browser hitting a web role. And what it's doing is it's showing me here, I have some photographs and storage, and here is showing me thumbnails of the photos. I can go browse and add a photo to it like this, there, and submit that. And it's going to churn for just a little bit. And now it should be plugged in. And when I go and shut it down and run this thing again, you will see. There it is. There's the thumbnail of the thing I just added. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. You're too kind. Okay, so what's going on here? How is this happening? Why is this useful from an Azure point of view? To do that, let me show you this diagram here that is at the that's here in the Lesson 2 demo instructions. Here, what we've got is we've got a web role over here, and number 0, the web role displays thumbnails of pictures to users. It comes up. It looks in this blob container and looks for thumbnail pictures. And when it finds it, it displays them to the user. And that's what you saw here. Right? That's what you saw here. This web browser came up and looked in the storage, found these thumbnail pictures, and is displaying them to me and you. All right. Okay. Then when you go to upload a picture, that's what I did. I uploaded the koala picture. The web role puts a message in the queue, like here. It uploads the blob here. The picture itself it uploads to the blob container, and we'll see about blobs and blob containers in the next lesson. Then to get the thumbnail. To get this thumbnail, the web role doesn't know from thumbnails. So the web role takes a message and puts it in a queue. It says here, make a thumbnail for this new blob that I just put up. Now I've got a worker role. And the worker role, every now and again, checks the queue, finds that, aha, there's a new message, goes to the blob container, fetches the picture that the message said to use, fetches the picture, generates a thumbnail, and puts the thumbnail there. And then the web role, again, number 5, displays said thumbnail. So that's what we're seeing. The web role uploads blobs to the container and puts a message in the queue for the worker role. The worker role fetches the message, gets the specified blob, makes the thumbnail, and puts it in the blob container. Doesn't pass them, the worker role does not pass a message back to the web role, though you could add that in homework if you wanted to. Instead, the web role just periodically polls to see if there are any new thumbnails. We're going to be looking at the storage more in the next lesson. So what this is primarily about is the web role taking the information and putting the message in a queue, the worker role fetching the message from the queue and doing something with it. And that's what we're looking at primarily in this lesson. Okay, here, switching back now to Visual Studio here, and I might as well stop debugging so you can see the comments. Here is my web role. And if you go look in default.aspx here, there, here we are in default.aspx. And we're going to go look at the submit button because that's where the interesting parts start for the message passing that we're looking at. In the next lesson, when we talk about blobs, we'll start a little bit earlier here. But right now, we're only talking about message passing, blobs in the next lesson. Right? So remember, the user selects a file with a dialog box. And that is this upload, remember, that is the upload control that is used in ASP.NET for uploading a file. All right. And what we now need to do, we need to do a couple things here. We're going to get the file name out of the dialog box. That's not real interesting. Here we are creating a new name that's going to be used for the photo itself in the blob container. Again, we take the name of the file, put a timestamp on it, generate a brand new GUID to make sure it's unique. There we are uploading it. And again, I'm not going to go into the code now. I'm going to go into this code next time. The interesting piece happens here. All right. What we need to do is this. Again, going back to this diagram here. We're going to do this here. The web role. It uploads the blob. That's the code that I just skipped over. But now the web role is going to come to the queue. It's going to put this message here. Make a thumbnail for this new blob, please. That's what this is going to do. That's what we're going to do right now. Okay, going back to Visual Studio here. Get thumbnail maker queue. This is our own utility function. All right. This is our own utility function. If I right-click, say go to definition there, it jumps me up to the top here, get thumbnail maker queue, and it calls this method create once container and queue. Again, that's an internal convenience method. If I'll go to that definition there, here, create once container and queue. This has to get called once when you're provisioning the application. It creates the persistent storage structures. It creates the blob container. It's going to contain the blobs. Creates the queue that's going to contain our queue messages. So this gets called at application startup time. And here's the code. All right. We need to go fetch our cloud storage account here. There's this class called Cloud Storage Account, and it says from configuration setting. This says to read the connection string out of the config file. So back is going to come this object of class storage account. All right. I'm going to skip the blob code here because this has to do with blob containers that we don't care about. And then I'm going to come down here. There's my storage account. Create cloud queue client. That is to say the connection from the client side that allows us to talk to a queue. So this is going to create a cloud queue client. And then this here is going to say in the client, create a reference to a queue. And the queue's name is this. And now this one, queue, create if not exist, means actually create the structure. This sounds a little ass backwards, sort of. This sounds a little, confusing, a little convoluted, there are really only three function calls here. Here, create my client-side connection to a queue. From this client-side connection, tell it to look for a queue whose name is this, whose name is thumbnail maker. Look for a queue whose name is this. And now here, with that queue, with that connection, create it if it doesn't already exist. Sort of like creating a file control structure and then saying open the file. That's kind of what it is. All right. So if it looks a little bit convoluted, yeah, maybe it is. But these three lines of code are how I open the connection to my queue here on the client side. All right, so that's what I have now. And it's stored in this member variable here at the top, which you'll see there. Cloud queue client, that's where it gets stored, right? Queue storage right there, that's where it gets stored. Okay, I will come back down here. I'll come back to my submit button. And so here, get thumbnail maker queue. And that got me a reference to the queue, whose name is Thumbnail Maker, creating it if necessary. That says here, add a message, please. Add a message, and this message is pretty simple. It just has the file name in it. That's really the only thing that goes into the message. This is a pretty simple application. The message only means one thing. Guess what? There's a new blob whose name is this. Please create a thumbnail for it. Obviously, in production applications, we can have more complicated structures that would get passed by means of the queue. So that's what it looks like here on the client side. It's really pretty simple. Open the connection to the queue, creating it if necessary, and then go to that one and add a message with this name in it. That's really all it is on the client side, just not that hard. Okay, so that's what it looks like on the client side, the web role side. So the web role, again, puts the message into the queue there. Now the worker role is going to come fetch it out. Let's go look at this on the worker role side. Switch over to the worker role here, there. The worker role only has one function here. There's a utility create thumbnail, but the interesting piece here is run. That's when a worker role starts running, that's where it starts in a method called run. Stop me if I get too technical here. All right. And here we're going to do something very similar to creating the queue and our connection to the queue. It's going to be exactly the same code, and I mean exactly because I cut and pasted it, so I know it's the same code. Here, open use our storage account to get the client-side connection to a queue, go set up the control for a queue whose name is Thumbnail Maker, and now here, create that queue if it doesn't exist. Open it up if it does exist, but create it if it does not. All right, if we have to catch a storage exception, that's what that is. Now, here's what this worker role does, is it goes into an infinite loop and says here, check to see if we have a message in the queue. Okay, queue.getMessage, there it is, looking to see if we have a message in the queue. If we do have a message in the queue, then here, right there, message as string, convert the message into a string, and that string is the name of the thumbnail. So there we are, looking for a message. If we have a message, look at its contents. Right, so there's the dequeuing. And that enqueuing and that dequeuing are really what this lesson is about. That's what I meant to show here. I'll just go on a little more. There it is, decomposing the message to find the name of the blob. There it is, fetching the blob. There it is, creating a thumbnail from the blob. And there it is, putting the thumbnail into the container. But that has nothing to do with the message passing that I'm doing here. The message passing, concentrate just on that for now, please. The message passing is right here. Look to see if there's a message. If there is a message, fetch the message. And now go do more useful things with the message, which we'll talk about in the next lesson. All right, I'm going to browse for a photo. I'm going to put up the hydrangeas, submit that. Now, I'm switching over here. This is the Azure MMC Snap-in. You will find instructions as to how to get that in your in the materials that come with this. If you look here, here are the queues. And there actually is a queue here. The queue is named Thumbnail Maker. If you go and look, there's a message in the queue now. It was posted at 6:17 p.m. UTC, and if you look 2:17 p.m., it was posted just now. If you look at its properties here, okay, if you look at its content as string, right there, a little bit hard to see, but that's the time, that's the GUID, .jpg. You see there, .jpg? So that is the file name. That's what was put in the queue. So you can see this tool allows you to look at the storage. You can see that the queue exists. You can look at the contents of the queue. You can see the messages in the queue. A lot of times these messages will not be intelligible here. But if you look here, you can even see, again, here, if you look at the content as string, you know, if this was a video presentation, this wouldn't make any sense. But if you look at this, you can see, yes, that's the message that was put in the queue as well. So you can see that the web role really is putting the message in the queue for the worker role to see. All right. Okay, and now if I go back to Visual Studio, and if I change this down to a more... to a 1 second poll, say, and now run it. There it is, there's the hydrangea thumbnail being shown. If I go back to my MMC here and refresh this, there. And then if I look in Thumbnail Maker here, there my message is gone, so you can see, yes, it was fetched from the queue by the worker role. So for this limited sample, you see here what the web role does when the user clicks submit here. Is to obtain a reference to the Azure queue, creating it if necessary, place a message into that queue with a file name of the blob for which it wants a thumbnail. What the worker role does here is it creates a reference to the queue as before, goes into an infinite loop, looks for a message in the queue. If it finds one, it fetches the message out of the queue and then uses the contents of the message to find the name of the blob, to fetch the contents of the blob, to create a thumbnail of the blob and to store that thumbnail back in the blob container. In other words, to do the business logic that it once done. The key parts of this are to look at the message being enqueued by the web role and then being dequeued and acted upon by the worker role. And that's the lesson that I'm here to teach today.